From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, Channel View, Texas. In the shadow of the petrochemical industry, they've seen it all.
It's sad. There are so many explosions and stuff that I don't recall them all.
It was crazy. You never really experience anything till you watch a river catch fire. It was weird.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're bringing you part two of a podcast series about Channel View, an unincorporated community outside of Houston in the heart of America's petrochemical industry. The series is from our partners at Public Health Watch, a nonprofit newsroom, and it's called Fumed. It tells the story of two suburban Harris County residents who've challenged the powerful companies that are taking over their once peaceful neighborhood. What happens next tests their character, their community, and the very idea of what it means to be a true Texan. In the last episode, Carolyn Stone and Greg Moss settled into quiet lives in Channelview neighborhoods that suit their very different personalities. Carolyn and her husband live in an old house in South Channelview in the Lakeview Homes subdivision. It has a big backyard where she can garden, paint, and raise her two children. Greg lives upstream in the River Bottom, an isolated and marshy area in East Channelview, where he's free to boat and fish on the San Jacinto River. He has a manufactured home and a workshop where he repairs boats like Carolyn. He's content with the life that he has built for himself. But in the 1990s, industries and barges began to move in, and Channelview began to change. And there were explosions, fires, and floods. How do they cope with it all? Now here's episode two of Fumed.
On New Year's Day, 1989, the Houston Oilers took the field against the Buffalo Bills. Led by quarterback Warren Moon, the Oilers were fresh off a thrilling one-point playoff victory and ready to send Houston to its first conference championship in a decade. But Moon struggled. The Oilers faltered, and what felt like a magical season came crashing down to earth. In Channelview, about 20 miles from where the Oilers played in the Astrodome, Carolyn Stone and Greg Moss were about to experience a similar shock to the system. For years, the small riverside community had been their safe place, a rare source of solitude in chaotic and industrialized East Harris County. But all of that was about to change when a series of man-made and natural disasters began chipping away at their fragile sense of peace. Plant explosions, personal tragedies, even a fire that would engulf their beloved San Jacinto River.
There was fire on the water. There was gasoline in the water. There were fires popping up. It seemed like the entire world was on fire. Thick black smoke, as you can imagine, pouring into the sky.
I'm David Leffler from Public Health Watch. This is Fumed, an investigative podcast about the people who live in the shadows of America's chemical plants and oil refineries. This season, a group of stubborn Texans try to salvage what's left of their working-class community. That's a problem, though, because they live in East Harris County, where the petrochemical industry calls the shots. Just about the time Carolyn was settling into her new home in South Channelview, the late 1980s, Houston was recovering from a global recession in the oil industry. But it was still the petrochemical capital of North America. And East Harris County was still the focal point. The discovery of oil, black gold, in 1901 at the Spindletop oil field in East Texas had made the county's evolution inevitable. It was only about an hour from the oil fields and was home to Buffalo Bayou, a deep inland waterway that allowed boats to travel from the Gulf of Mexico up through Galveston Bay to downtown Houston. In 1914, the Port of Houston widened and dredged the bayou's southern reaches to create the Houston Ship Channel, a mile-wide waterway that served as a conduit for large ships. Soon, chemical plants, refineries, and other industrial facilities lined the channel. But much of the wealth produced in East Harris County flowed to the county's west side, and it's still that way today. The people who benefit most from the oil, gas, and chemical industries tend to live miles from the facilities whose profits fill their pockets. The first time I drove through River Oaks, a neighborhood just west of downtown Houston, it felt like I had crossed into another country. Homes there list in the multi-millions. Instead of the smell of chemicals, the aroma of fresh-cut grass permeates the air. People generally live longer there, too. According to a 2019 study by the Episcopal Health Foundation, people on the west side of Harris County can expect to live 21 years longer than people on the east side. Until the early 1990s, the southern and eastern parts of Channelview, where Carolyn and Greg live, were largely spared from the ship channel's industrial sprawl. The part of the San Jacinto that flowed along East Channelview, down to Buffalo Bayou and the ship channel, was still pretty clean back then. Blue crab, shrimp, and speckled trout flourished. Dolphins sometimes swam up from Galveston Bay. The river bottom, the marshy part of East Channelview where Greg settled, was a popular recreation spot. People flocked to the Riverside Inn, a beloved bar and burger joint. They'd swim, fish, boat, water ski, or just sit and watch ducks waddle across the street from placid ponds.
Everybody recreated on the water. There used to be a slalom course and another ski jump, and people used to water ski and do all kinds of stuff on this river like that. They used to have crab traps and shrimp boats pulling in here and everything.
Greg's boat repair business boomed.
I had so many boats. At one time, I had three guys helping me, and it was so crowded backing boats in here that we couldn't get in and out the driveway.
The only major industry even close to the river bottom was that old Texas Butadiene facility in North Channelview, near the trailer park where Carolyn and Bobby lived as newlyweds. It was now owned by Arco Chemical. There were some underwater pipelines that ran beneath the San Jacinto near the river bottom, and barges occasionally carried sand and other raw materials upstream. Some old barges had been left to rot in a cove locals referred to as the barge graveyard. Sometimes a barge broke loose and drifted a bit, but Greg didn't worry much about that because back then, the barges rarely carried chemicals. Greg assumed the river bottom was safe from major industrialization because it was north of the heavily trafficked Interstate 10 bridge that separated North and South Channelview. The bridge was so low that big ships couldn't pass through to the river bottom, so it acted as a sort of protective barrier.
There really wasn't that much industry around. It was all more up and down the ship channel. You don't expect anything bad to happen when you really don't have a whole lot of industry around.
Carolyn wasn't worried about her part of Channelview either back then. Houston doesn't have zoning laws to stop industrial facilities from moving into residential neighborhoods. And Harris County isn't much better. But Carolyn thought her home was protected. Her deed said that Lakeview Homes was zoned specifically for residential use. For average people in Harris County, that designation was worth almost as much as black gold. During my third trip to Channelview, I decided to visit one of the most sacred places in all of Texas. The site where Texas won its independence from Mexico in 1836 at the Battle of San Jacinto. By this time, I'd spent weeks in the area and was practically living at a Holiday Inn Express. But I hadn't yet taken the time to see the historic battlefield, an omission that surely would have disappointed my dad, had he still been alive. Now, of all places, you would think Texas would have protected one of its most revered sites from the encroaching petrochemical industry. But you'd be wrong. On a steamy July morning, I joined two other Public Health Watch reporters and our podcast producer at the San Jacinto Monument. We were there to meet historian Kate Johnson. You guys talk. The summer sun was overpowering. We had to squint to admire the 567-foot obelisk, which is topped by a 220-ton star. It's the world's tallest war memorial because, as they say, everything's bigger in Texas. 1,200 acres of preserved battlefields and parkland surrounded us, but the waterside stretches of land have been marred by industrial expansion. Kate said the San Jacinto River was between 25 to 70 feet across in 1836. Since then, it's been widened to more than 400 feet in some places, destroying habitats filled with wildlife and the river's namesake flower, the Jacinto.
When the first Spanish explorers came out, they said it was just kind of choked with these giant flowers, and so they called it the San Jacinto River.
Critical landmarks were bulldozed and desecrated, too. The tree where Mexican General Antonio López de Santa Anna famously surrendered to Sam Houston, it was washed away in 1924. The homestead and family cemetery of Lorenzo de Zavala, which once sat across the river from the monument, is gone, too. De Zavala was the first vice president of the Republic of Texas. He also helped write the Texas Constitution. But by the time we took our tour, his homestead had been replaced by a facility that manufactures chemical tanks. A fleet of barges carrying volatile chemicals to and from petrochemical plants lined its shores.
About the history of the battleground, so I'm going to take them up to the top.
When we met Kate, she was the Texas Historical Commission's lead educator at the San Jacinto Battleground State Historic Site. Now she works for the National Park Foundation. I had to ask her, would the homestead have been preserved if De Zavala, who was born in Mexico, had been a white revolutionary like Sam Houston, the general who won the Battle of San Jacinto?
Absolutely. Sam Houston's home is preserved. He died in a place called Steamboat House up in Huntsville, and that's been preserved. It wouldn't have been turned into a concrete silo.
At the end of our tour, we took an elevator to the top of the monument. Through rows of windows equipped with telescopic tower viewers, I could see the verdant field of grass and trees where my home state had been birthed. But the view was framed by a sea of chemical tanks, ships, barges, and flares as far as the eye could see. History seemed like an afterthought. Kate said the first time she visited the monument, she thought the same thing.
I grew up in Texas, but I'd never actually been to San Jacinto. And as I'm driving down, there's refineries and refineries, and there's, you know, giant flares up in the sky. And I started to panic, and I was like, there's no way there's a historic battlefield here.
In the early 90s, a series of disasters began chipping away at Carolyn and Greg's fragile sense of peace. Just before midnight on July 5th, 1990, that old butadiene plant in North Channelview, by then owned by ARCO, blew up. The blast shot flames into the sky and shook houses miles away.
17 workers were killed.
It's a city block of blasted metal. Vehicles arrived to remove victims from ARCO Chemical in Channelview. Anyone close was too close. Workers mourn but don't dwell on the threat.
It was one of the deadliest industrial disasters in Harris County history.
Inspector just came back from the plant, and said that his walkthrough was like looking where a tornado of fire had run through. Just complete destruction, a leveling, if you will, probably the best way to describe what took place.
I asked Carolyn if she felt the blast from her house.
I honestly don't recall. It's sad. There are so many explosions and stuff that I don't recall them all. It's crazy. And that, to me, is a statement of conditioning. That's a horrible reality. I won't even say statement. It's a horrible reality.
Two years after the ARCO explosion, an F4 tornado tore through Channelview.
While the twisters moved west to east indiscriminately across much of Harris County, clearly the greatest amount of devastation was suffered in Channelview in East Harris County.
The streets here are flooded with slime and muck, and there is debris everywhere.
The nearly mile-wide twister destroyed at least 1,000 homes and businesses. Luckily, it didn't hit any petrochemical facilities or touch Carolyn or Greg's neighborhoods. Houston meteorologist and Space City Weather managing editor Matt Lanza said it was the strongest tornado in the Houston area on record, and a jolting reminder of Channelview's vulnerability to severe weather.
You know, you don't really think of tornadoes as being a threat here, but Channelview is kind of located in an interesting little area that I think is more susceptible to maybe tornadoes happening more frequently than other parts of the Houston area because of their proximity to water. For the Houston area, I think that east side up through Channelview is kind of like our tornado alley. I mean, it's just something else to think about, right, among all the disasters that we have here.
The next disaster in 1993, a year after the tornado, was a very personal one for Carolyn. Carolyn had long accepted the fact that her husband took on dangerous jobs, volunteering as a firefighter and driving trucks in the oil and chemical industries.
I mean, he hauled some chemicals that you had an antidote that you had to have, but you really didn't have time to administer the antidote because if a drop of it got on you, you were basically dead within just a few seconds. What are you going to do? But I mean, he was a firefighter shortly after I started dating him. So it's always been part of the deal. So yeah, you make peace with it, I guess.
Carolyn said Bobby always followed safety protocols to a T. But when you're working with some of the most volatile materials in the world, any day could be your last, even when you do everything right. It took a series of phone calls for Carolyn to tell me what happened to Bobby on September 28th, 1993. She was leaving work for her lunch break when she spotted something burning in the distance at one of Bobby's job sites.
As I pull out of the parking lot, I see the black cloud coming up over the tunnel. And I knew Bobby was there. That was my first thought, that facility had blown up. I could see the flames and stuff above the tree line.
Carolyn scrambled to find a payphone. But when she called the facility, they couldn't confirm if Bobby was on the premises, let alone if he had been injured. She was told to stand by for more information.
You talk about people who they have the premonition or the feeling or whatever. I truly did. I started getting sick. I see smoking explosions all the time. But in my heart of hearts, I knew he was there. There was no doubt. When I pulled in at work, they greeted me at the door and told me that a man had called and that Bobby had been in an explosion.
It turns out that Bobby was at a fuel loading facility when the engine of a coworker's truck ignited gasoline vapors that were hanging in the air. It caused a massive explosion. The two men had to be life-flighted to a burn center in Houston.
I do not know how I made it to Herman Hospital because I remember leaving the parking lot and I remember walking in the emergency room. I was on total automatic. I'm standing in the doorway of the room, and Bobby's laying on the bed, the table there. Doctor's running all around. He's got tubes and the stuff all in him, and literally his skin is laying on the bed beside him.
Bobby didn't want to be interviewed for this podcast. Carolyn said it's still difficult for him to talk about that day. It's tough for her, too. She laughs when she's upset.
Sorry. I'm getting a little upset. There was a long recovery period. Not sure we're still quite recovered.
On October 20th, 1994, a little over a year after Bobby's accident, one of the biggest floods in Channelview history swept through the area. Channelview, especially the river bottom, where Greg lived, has always been vulnerable to floods. It's sandwiched between the Gulf of Mexico, whose warm, shallow waters often fuel hurricanes, and the Lake Houston Dam. During heavy rainstorms, the dam's floodgates are opened to protect the homes of wealthy people who live near the lake. The wall of water the gates release hurtles downstream toward Channelview. The floods are so frequent there that Greg uses hurricanes as reference points for major events in his life. But October 20th, 1994, was unlike any flood Greg had ever seen.
Roads are cut off, and the water is still rising. The river has risen faster than anybody can remember.
We talked about it one day under the buzz of the fluorescent lights in his workshop, while his companion, Dog, and Deanie ran around. Greg estimates the San Jacinto's waters rushed by the river bottom at about 30 miles an hour. He and some friends jumped into boats and formed a ragtag rescue team. They saved people, but also...
Me and Ross and Smitty and Wayne and several others were out pulling emus because the guy had an emu farm up there. And back then, it was like, those things were like 20 grand a piece. They were alive. The water cut through where all their pens were. So we were out there grabbing them things by the neck and getting them on the shoreline and holding them.
As the floodwaters rose, Carolyn felt safe in her house. It sits on some of the highest ground in Channelview. But her feeling of safety was shattered the next afternoon when there was a terrifying development.
In San Jacinto River, east of Channelview.
Trees and homes are engulfed. Residents and nearby refinery workers flee the fast-moving flames.
Just yesterday, we were talking about floods. Today, it is fire of the most unimaginable sort in the Houston area.
All of this began early this morning when a pipeline ruptured on the San Jacinto River.
You heard that right. The San Jacinto River was on fire. According to dozens of people who told me about that day, the hard rains and flooding dislodged an old sand barge from that barge graveyard upstream near the river bottom. As the barge hurtled south, it slammed into a 40-inch pipeline that had floated to the top of the river as the water rose. Greg watched from a hill as hundreds of thousands of gallons of gasoline gushed into the river and then ignited.
You could smell all the gasoline all over the water, and it was big pools of it. And it looked like it was several inches thick, like football field-sized pools, several inches thick of gasoline. They had a bunch of trailers parked along the water line, and the gas fumes got into a pilot light or a generator exhaust or something, and it just, boom, man, in a fire, it just shot out. The news helicopter said it was running 85 miles an hour. The flame front. It was probably doing every bit of that.
Greg saw flaming floodwaters 10 feet high rush into the river bottom.
And then the fire spread into a neighborhood of residential homes that had already been inundated by floodwaters. There was fire on the water. There was gasoline in the water. There were fires popping up on one side of the street. And it seemed like the entire world was on fire. Thick black smoke, as you can imagine, pouring into the sky.
Greg did what any smart person would do. He ran.
You know, I had a Pontiac Fiero at the time, you know, there was fire everywhere. And it was just kept going boom, 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 you know, and a big old black clouds of smoke and everything. And we hauled down the road. I grabbed a Will. He was the handyman over there at the bar. I said, get in here, let's go, you know. We run down Magnolia Street. My buddy Dale, I mean, he was dead run. I said, get on, get on. He jumped on the luggage rack of the car, and we hauled up to the Shell station.
While Greg was running away from the flames, Carolyn was running toward them. Her children's elementary school was close to the river. It was also less than a mile from the rebuilt Arco Chemical plant. And the river fire was headed that way.
When I got to the school, there was already a bunch of parents there. You have a whole group of parents who are beating on the door wanting to get their kids. The school has the doors locked and yelling at us, telling us we can't have our kids, that they were doing shelter in place. There was the river on fire right down at the end of the road, and they're like trying to tell us to leave. Who in their right mind would leave their kids?
The fire finally burned itself out around 6 p.m. A 10-mile oil slick covered the river from north of Interstate 10 through the Houston Ship Channel to the northern stretches of Galveston Bay. The river bottom was in shambles. Trees charred, homes gone. Greg's first workshop was burned to a crisp.
It was crazy. You never really experience anything until you watch a river catch fire. It was weird.
The river fire of 94 became a sort of marker for Channelview residents. The time when the good old days began fading away, and the industrial takeover truly began. Next time on Fumed. A barge company moves in across the street from Carolyn, sparking a desperate fight to preserve her peaceful way of life.
It was like a moment of extreme desperation. It's like being in the penthouse of a skyscraper in the elevator and the brakes failing and you're plummeting down. There's no stopping it, but you're grasping and you're pushing buttons.
Fumed is a production of Public Health Watch. It was written and reported by me, David Leffler. Additional reporting by Savannah Strott and Selena Arredondo. Susan White was my editor. Our executive producer was Jordan Goss-Poré. Our senior producer was Selena Arredondo. Savannah Strott was an assistant producer. Yana Cholakovska and Jordan Goss-Poré provided additional research. Our music was composed and performed by Michael Ramos. Additional music by Epidemic Sound. Mark Bush was our sound engineer. Fact checking by Enna Alvarado. Artwork by Matthew Fleming. Special thanks to our distribution partners at Texas Public Radio and to the Texas Tribune for studio and technical support. Also, thanks to Joanne Farian, Lynn Perry, and Chris Worthington for their advice and encouragement. Jim Morris is the executive director and editor-in-chief of Public Health Watch. To see pictures of Carolyn and Greg and learn more about Channelview, go to fumedpodcast.com.
That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. There are past episodes of Texas Matters on our website at tpr.org, and you can find us wherever you download cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.